weather today in the Grand.
I love you so badly, I could.
They're solid plastic, so don't settle for imitation.
But the senator, while insisting he was not intoxicated, could not explain his nudity.
Good evening, this is Sarah Chapman, and this is the Best of an Alan Smithy podcast. You give us 80 minutes and we'll give you 80 minutes of words. How many times a day do you change your underwear? Because Owen Fletcher changes his identity more often than he changes your underwear. Than he changes his underwear. More often than you change your underwear. Thank goodness there's more than one man for the job from the 7th of December 2012. Two times the Richard Libertini, two times the Michael Ritchie, two times the Chevy Chase, two times the Fletch. It's a double feature discussion of 1985's Fletch and 1989's Fletch Lives.
Hey, hey, we're gonna go out tonight. Hey, 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 we're gonna go out tonight. We're gonna have some fun, everything gonna be alright.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about double features of films. Sometimes we even do commentary tracks. This episode is a double feature of Fletch. Now, Fletch, you may or may not know, was a 1985 career high point for Chevy Chase. I mean, it wasn't like one of his biggest grossing movies, but okay, the general consensus on Chevy Chase is pretty poor, but even people who don't like him have to admit, like, you know, he did two or three good movies, and Fletch is definitely one of them. It kind of came at a odd point in his career, I guess, because this is like, well, actually, no, it came during the peak, but also kind of when he was just about to step off the cliff and start tumbling down. This European Vacation came out in 85 also. And then like he just kind of got pigeonholed into doing that. But like, it's just a really good, it's just like the ideal Chevy Chase movie. I don't know that or Foul Play, but like, it's just like the right vehicle for his persona. He's, flippant and glib and wisecracking and sarcastic and everything. And, you know, the movie's about a wisecracking reporter. And the funny thing was, like, because this came out the year after Beverly Hills Cop, they tried to give it kind of an edge that I don't think it would have had otherwise. Like, it's pretty goofy, but at the same time, they're trying to do a real mystery story of it because it was based on a series of mystery novels, the first one of which had came out all the way back in 74. And, you know, the mystery novels were comedic, but, you know, people died. It was definitely kind of hard-edged. And I think they were trying to turn this into, like, a new Beverly Hills Cop. And to that effect, they even got Harold Faltermeyer.
Yeah.
Harold Faltermeyer, you know, who did the act. He hasn't done that many movies, actually, but Fletch is one of them, and you know the little synthesizer tunes that he comes up with in Fletch are just as catchy as the Axel F theme, I think. And it's just a really enjoyable, really good movie overall, and I got really into it, like, God, 10 years ago, because there were all these rumors flying around that Kevin Smith was going to relaunch Fletch with Jason Lee. And I was like, what's this Fletch movie? Why does Kevin Smith care? And I went back and I watched it and I was like, wow, this is neat. And then, like, I became a big fan and I was all geared up for the new Fletch movie to come out anytime. And 10 or so years later, I'm still waiting. And it's, seems like probably less of a, well, if it happens now, it's not going to have Kevin Smith or Jason Lee, that's for sure. It's probably not even going to have Chevy Chase. In fact, that's almost a certainty now.
Yeah, We talked about doing this episode, and we really didn't time it for Chevy Chase quitting Community. It just worked out that way. I saw it as a kid, and I think it played a lot on TV, or it was one of the ones that eventually did, because I remember when I was a kid going to see Fletch Lives was one of the big, my first opening night by myself movies with my friends. And so I kind of stopped once I started seeing other stuff as a teenager, like R-rated movies, because Fletch was PG. I mean, it's like edgy and everything, but it's pre blatant PG-13ing that started in like 86 or so. You know, it was still relatively early. So it's kind of like a white guy, Beverly Hills Cop without the swearing type thing. Yeah. Down to not just the Harold Faltermeyer score, but also the song that Fletch has, like the theme song, and it sounds kind of like the Pointer Sisters, who did a song for Beverly Hills Cop. Like, the two really feel alike.
Yeah, it's Stephanie Mills and singing, and the song is produced by Faltermeyer.
Yeah. So, I mean, the two really do feel alike. And then, you know, the sequel came out, and I think we'll get to that in a bit. But then I came back to Fletch because it was one of the first DVDs that Universal ever released. And I'd never seen it widescreen. And so I think that was the, like, when DVDs first came out and they started releasing things that never warranted a re-release on Laserdisc. Like, you know, Fletch probably came out on Laserdisc in 85, and it was pan and scan. Nobody gave a crap. And then once Laserdisc caught on with, not collectors, but whatever,
Elitist.
There you go. Perfect. Elitist movie fans with some money to spend. It never warranted a re-release. There was never, you know, a special Fletch Laserdisc. So I got the DVD thinking, hey, this is cool. Like, I'm going to get to see Fletch widescreen for the first time. Like, and yeah, now you don't even think about it.
You don't get that much more. I mean, it was shot in 185.
Yeah, but still. So, and when I was watching it this time, I realized, because I don't think I've seen it since... I mean, I might have seen it in between the last time when I first got it on DVD and now, but I don't really remember it. But I do remember watching it now that, you know, I watched it on a good DVD player. Like, I spent money on a DVD, my first DVD player, and I was watching it on a good TV. And yeah, still, it looks better on my little iPad, not the iPad mini, but the old iPad 1 that everybody says looks like crap compared to all the other ones. The picture quality from what's probably the same transfer looks like 30 times better than I could even imagine it looking on television. Like, it's crazy to see Fletch like this, because the last time I saw it, it was... It didn't look right on the TV, you know? You could see the pixels and stuff, and so I think that... And I'll get to this in the second half, but, you know, Michael Ritchie and especially the cinematographer, they really got, at the beginning, they established it as sort of gritty, you know, he's on a case, he's on the beach, there are bombs, I mean, it's like...
Yeah. Well, it opens, first of all, like, in the very first shot, you've got Chevy Chase narrating, so it immediately establishes, like, that this is a mystery story. He's not a private eye, but he's an investigative journalist, and he's narrating, and he's talking about how he's on this beach because he's trying to find out who's dealing drugs on the beach. There's a drug crisis, and you got the Harold Faltermeyer tune going, and you're kind of like, all right, well, this is quasi-gritty, and then 2 minutes later or 1 minute later, like, he's talking to Norm. And we're supposed to buy Norm as like this skeezy drug dealer on the beach, and you know, if you're over a certain age, you kind of realize how silly it is. But I guess you can kind of buy. Okay, not really. You have to be a kid to buy this stuff. But hey, it was PG. They were expecting kids to see this movie.
I think that they do get some of it because not so much because of Norm or Norm's sidekick, but the Creasy character, the teenager who's got like 10 lines, Fletch goes over to and says, you know, you're not really taking very good care of yourself. Now, in a comedy today, in a Will Ferrell comedy, the movie would end with you discovering that that character was really a millionaire and or some shit. But Fletch kind of lets him disappear and presumably die of a drug overdose somewhere down the road. It's like not nice.
Yeah. And the other thing that's not nice is Fletch's character because, I don't know, he's trying to crack this drugs on the beaches story, but when the junkie is going on about, you know, when's Norm going to have more heroin, and Fletch goes, you know, you're not taking very good care of yourself. It's like, because it's Chevy Chase and because his delivery is skirting the line between sarcasm and sincerity, you don't know if he's just like belittling this junkie for his own amusement or if he's genuinely concerned. And I guess it's kind of up to the audience member to decide. But presumably, you know, it is a laugh line and we are, I guess, supposed to laugh at this junkie's troubles. The movie's a little schizophrenic like that because much later on, like, we see the cops show up and they start beating up on this one junkie and Fletch is all like, hey, you can't do that. And then he throws a rock through the cop's window. And I guess, you know, it's like, oh, wow, Fletch cares for these junkies and he cares about police brutality. So I don't know. I think the movie's a little confused about its own intentions in that regard. I read the novel I'd read the novel before, like after I saw the movie, and you know, the novel, I guess it, you know, might go without saying that the novel's different. It's definitely a lot more serious. It still has comedy, but just so far as like the drugs on the beaches thing goes, there's a 15-year-old girl junkie on the beach who Fletch, you know, takes up with. I don't think he sleeps with her, but like she dies at one point and you know, it's kind of meant to ground things in seriousness. And if there were like a, you know, teenage, I don't know, maybe in some draft of the script, the junkie who he says isn't taking very good care of himself was supposed to be this teenage girl, and they were like, "Eh, that's a little too much of a bummer for a Chevy Chase comedy." Let's not forget, you know, this is like 2 years after Vacation, and you know, families are going to see this. So, it's funny. You might think that the whole movie is about this drugs on the beaches story from our description of it so far. But really, that's just a preamble to this other story about how Tim Matheson is going to hire Fletch to murder him because he has cancer and he wants his wife to get the inheritance. But then Fletch discovers, you know, does some digging and he finds out that he's healthy as a horse, and it's like, why does he want me to murder him? And then that's really the main plot of the movie. By the way, the other big difference between the book and the movie is that even though Fletch does in the book make up names and call people on the phone and give fake names and stuff, he does not put on a variety of goofy disguises to do his investigation. Whereas, yeah, you know, I guess to make it more visual and considering that they had Chevy Chase, that's the way they wanted to go in the movie. Although funny enough, I mean, it was like the Fletch series was like, you know, a big enough book series that it was like a big deal that they were going to make a Fletch movie and they were considering big names and, you know, I mean, relatively big names. I think like Burt Reynolds was being considered and the author of the novels, what's his name? Gregory MacDonald had the final say on who would be cast. And when they suggested Chevy Chase, he was like, yeah, all right, I can see it. So I don't know.
I mean, it sort of made his career in some ways. Cause if you look at it, he started out and he had Foul Play and Caddyshack and Seems Like Old Times. Then he sort of faltered with Under the Rainbow and Modern Problems, right? Mm-hmm. Then there was Vacation, which was a hit, and then Deal of the Century was a bomb. Then he did Fletch, which was a hit. I think European Vacation was a bomb. Spies Like Us did well. Three Amigos. But then didn't he did Funny Farm was an incredible bomb. And that was supposed to be his breakthrough. And it's kind of like Fletch being, you know, smack in the middle of the 80s is sort of the defining Chevy Chase movie. I guess now one might think of Christmas Vacation as the defining one, but at the time it was not a hit. Christmas Vacation caught on later. So, I mean, for a long time, when people thought of good Chevy Chase movies, they were thinking of Fletch, unless they were, you know, they knew about his sort of late 70s stuff. And I think it's also interesting that he's narrating this. He's a reporter. I'm wondering if they were kind of playing on Weekend Update a little.
I guess so. I mean,
and I felt that at times, like a nicer, I mean, he's kind of lovable in this one, which, when you think of Chevy Chase now, it's hard to ever imagine that he was supposed to be lovable.
Yeah. Well, I guess, yeah, he is supposed to be kind of lovable. Okay, he's the first thing we learn about him is that he's trying to crack a drugs on the beaches story, so he's got that going for him. He's a civic-minded investigative journalist, and then, you know, when Tim Matheson hires him to kill him, Tim Matheson, you know, we know that there's got to be something fishy about this, and he's super waspy, and he was the, you know, super waspy guy in Animal House, and yeah, he is lovable for sure. And then, like, what's the next thing that he happened to him after he goes sneaks into a hospital and finds out that Tim Matheson is healthy? We see him. Okay, well, then he goes to a country club and he meets Tim Matheson's wife and they flirt with each other, and that's like whatever. But then I think the moment, you know, I think we're kind of sold on him about, you know, pretty late into the starting time, but at about the halfway point or half hour point into the movie, we see him go to his apartment and have to deal with his ex-wife's lawyer picking up the alimony. And the lawyer is like such a twerp that you definitely kind of side with Fletch at that point. And I really like that scene because Fletch's apartment really looks so lived in. Like, whoever the set decorator was did a really good job. It really looks like someone's apartment and, you know, a journalist's apartment, a journalist who's also a big basketball fan.
I think it's the only scene in the movie that's actually inside the apartment. Because later when he goes back, he can't go in because the cops are after him. And it's incredibly distinctive. And he takes a nap, and then he has the dream.
Something about after the lawyer has left, and there's this kind of like moody, contemplative Harold Faltermeyer music, and he tosses a basketball into a hoop and cracks open a beer, and he lays down on his bed and loosens his tie, and I don't know. There's something endearing about it.
Yeah.
You feel like you're hanging out in the guy's apartment just watching him relax after after a day of shenanigans. Because up until then, it's been pretty silly stuff. I mean, yeah, he sneaks into a hospital by saying his name is Dr. Rosenropen or Dr. Rosenpenis or whatever. He's kind of, you know, I think I liked this movie as a 13 or 14 year old because he's just like pulling the wool over everyone's eyes and giving fake names and sneaking into places and getting away with stuff, and you kind of like him on that level of being like a, you know, a trickster.
But
I don't know, this time around all I can do is marvel at like how credulous the people who he gives these fake names to are and be like, how come people don't point out how awful his disguises are? How could anybody be falling for this? Of course, in Fletch Lives, it's even worse, but
and that's sort of the thing, is it realistic, or do you have to it's supposed to be realistic, but you also have to buy into the disguises. And I think that comes up with the when he's a mechanic, and it's like a vaguely dangerous situation, yet the character sort of doesn't respond to it. But there's also the police corruption thing going on. And then, I mean, it's a fast movie. It's 96, 98 minutes. And, I mean, it goes by really, really fast.
Yeah, it has a very playful kind of pace. And it's just like an easy, breezy kind of movie that kind of helps gloss over how silly it is that people are buying his disguises and his fake names, because he kind of slips in and out quickly enough that you don't mind. And then when he fools those mechanics, they even kind of, you know, Chevy Chase's voiceover kind of acknowledges how absurd it is, because he says, I splurged and I invested 49 cents in a set of novelty teeth for this. Seems crappy novelty teeth in.
Yeah. And then there's the car chase, which comes pretty soon after that. And the car chase sort of is the most unreal moment in the movie.
Well, because it's, like, really good. You're kind of not expecting, like, such a well-shot car chase. But I think they felt like they had to appeal to people who liked Beverly Hills Cop.
Right, yeah, you can't have a Harold Faltermeyer movie without a car chase.
Exactly.
Let's see, so...
I think the other moment early on in, before... 20 minutes before the before you see him relaxing in his apartment, at about the 10-minute mark, when, you know, after he's been on the beach and after offered the money to kill Tim Matheson, he steps into the newspaper office and there's this really happy Faltermeyer music happening and everybody, hey, Fletch! And then, like, Gina Davis, who just looks, you know, gorgeous. This is, you know, like her fourth movie or something, comes up and Fletch is like, hey, Larry, you know, I got a favor. Can you look into files on Alan Stanwyck? And Richard Lippertini is all like, Fletch, I need that drugs on the beaches story. And it's like, oh, look at this guy. He's, you know, he's hardworking. And Gina Davis is his girl Friday. Richard Lippertini is his haranguing but well-meaning boss, and it just feels like a franchise.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like it'd be hard for them to mess it up, but...
like, I want to watch three or four movies where Chevy Chase is going to go out and wear disguises and then come back to the office, and Gina Davis is going to be there, and Richard Lippertini is going to be there.
Yeah. we're not ready for the segue yet, but that would have been a perfect one. Yeah, and I mean, that sort of the supporting cast, like everybody, it's perfect. I mean, they're all awesome. Which I think is what makes Tim Matheson even more frustrating, because he's awful. I guess some of it is I don't really like... I mean, Tim Matheson does a thing. If you've seen Animal House, you've seen Tim Matheson's thing. He's, you know, the white guy. And in this one, especially at the end, there's the script to be more complex and to make the mystery more involved gives Tim Matheson these things that... You know, he's not really acting. He doesn't really convince you of his... Oh, right. We spoil movies all the time. So you find out that he's a bigamist and that he really loves his first wife. Well, you never believe that when you see Tim Matheson. I mean, like... That's what I mean, this time you're trying to imagine, I'm like, so wait, his, like, little Utah wife thinks that this is okay? I mean, and it's one of those things where it's in the days before the internet, so I guess people could be bigamists and all that stuff, but...
Pre-internet movie. I mean, you know, forget the fact that it's a newspaper comedy. It's also about, you know, having to get by on phones. And
yeah.
Not having ways to verify people's identity immediately, you know, that's how he gets away with all this stuff. Actually, in the novel, it's the same deal, but slight difference. Stanwyck is not yet married to his high school sweetheart. He's like planning on going back to her after he fakes his death. And also a big difference from the book. Well, the movie ties together the drugs on the beaches and the Tim Matheson plots, which is pretty contrived. But
yeah,
at the end of the book also, they're separate, but Stanwyck still ends up getting shot by the chief of police because of mistaken identity, because the chief of police has followed Fletch back to Stanwyck's place. And he tries to kill him in revenge for, you know, exposing him as the source of the drugs on the beach. So you've got the irony of Stanwyck getting killed by the chief of police because the chief of police thought Stanwyck was Fletch, when that was what Stanwyck was trying to do all along, is have them switch identities. Oh, and speaking of chief of police, Joe Don Baker, this is one of my favorite Joe Don Baker roles. I don't know about you, but as the murderous police chief Carlin, who's prepared to shoot Fletch in cold blood and then stab himself in the arm to do they make movies that are this anti-LAPD anymore?
I never think about that, because I feel like in the 90s, like Chicago became the city of corrupt cops.
And maybe after Rodney King, it was considered a little bit of a cliche. But in Fletch, it's just like, yeah, the chief of police is behind the drug traffic on the beaches, and he's a cold-blooded killer.
And all of the cops are in on it. I mean, it's like that's one of the other big plot holes in it, is not all the cops are after Fletch, and you're just kind of like, so all of these are bad guys? Like, because...
Yeah, exactly.
It's a lot.
A little hard to swallow, because he ends up getting, like, chased. You know, the car chase that we mentioned earlier is, like, the cops are after him, and he manages to elude them just by, what else, pretend, you know, momentarily pretending to be somebody else and diverting attention and then making his escape. And, you know, nobody gets away from the LAPD like that, you know. It's a little much, but that kind of struck me this time around, is like, wow, this movie is very, very anti-police. It's got a very conspiratorial bent to it.
Well, and that is a big difference between it and Beverly Hills Cop, right? Because Beverly Hills Cop was, they were uncool, but they weren't corrupt.
Yeah,
and I think, I guess, a big change would have come with Lethal Weapon. That was when you really had the 87 was when you really had the heroic LA cops. Mm-hmm. But I mean, Fletch is, I mean, that scene is, it's disturbing because,
yeah,
it's played for humor, but it's also serious. And I mean, I like Joe Don Baker a lot, but he's not like, I feel like the script fails him, because the whole thing, they don't spend enough time making me believe that the chief of police of Los Angeles is really running a drug ring. It's like too small, right? It's like LA is the newspaper office, Fletch's apartment, and the beach. And,
well, not that it wasn't like shot all over LA.
It was shot all over LA, but those are like the primary focus points. And I mean, there's like one plot hole where Fletch calls up his boss and he's like, I can't come in. They're watching the building. You know, they'll kill me if I try to get in there. And the boss doesn't believe him. And then, like, you know, 15, 20 minutes later, he brings the chief's two co-conspirators into the building. And he's in the disguise. He's in one of the funnier disguises. And I think that disguise was used a lot in the trailers, because it's when he's the roller skating, mystic guy. And the thing is it's like, okay, so the cops weren't on the lookout for these two guys leaving the beach for the first time ever to go to the newspaper office. And so I just feel like Joe Don Baker was the biggest victim of that. Like, Tim Matheson was never going to be able to do this role right, because Tim Matheson is just not... Yeah, he's just not... I mean, I don't know. But and then they you have the Dana Wheeler Nicholson, and she's great. But the scene where Jodan Baker, you get that insanity from Jodan Baker that he had back in what was his first movie? Charlie Varick, where he was the hitman. He was just the vicious hitman named, like, Sandy or something.
I love when Jodan Baker plays bad guys. He's really good at it.
He is really good at it. It's, and you know that that's like, he's like, that's not me. And but it really is. It's really him.
That is one of those moments when he's, you know, threatening to kill Fletch that the movie does kind of ground itself as being a serious mystery story with stakes involved, you know, including Fletch's own life. And like Chevy Chase makes that work, because even though he's goofy Chevy Chase in 90% of the movie, there is that 10% when his life is in danger and he acts like it is. He's not just, you know, winking at the camera like, uh-oh, this guy's got a gun on me. What am I going to do, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And that happens at the end of the movie too, when, you know, all the threads come together and Dana Wheeler Nicholson and Chevy Chase and Jodan Baker and Tim Matheson are all together and, you know, everybody's shooting everybody.
And that's a that's another memorable scene. It's really weird. I mean, I must have seen Fletch lots in my life. Not lately, but I must have seen a lot. And those scenes really stick out. The apartment scene really sticks out. The general impression of the beach sticks out. The scene at the end, the shootout scene. And none of them are particularly long scenes. So it's kind of weird that certain scenes don't, like, there's a very long involved scene where he breaks into a office and he has a chase scene with a dog, and it's well done, and I mean it freaks you out at the end a little. The scene where the dog jumps through the plate glass window, I mean, that's creepy, you know, it's scary, but that's not as memorable for whatever reason as the final scene. And I think that some of that's Ritchie. I mean, he does.
Yeah. Michael Ritchie, who directed this movie and also directed some really great movies in the 70s, like Bad News Bears and Smile and The Candidate. He's just a damn good comedy director. And some of the scenes, like, it's just the way he cuts back and forth between the actors that really makes it work. Definitely, like, any of the scenes with Chevy Chase and Dana Wheeler Nicholson are really helped by the editing and the direction. And Ritchie is really, really good at just making two person dialogue scenes visually interesting and having good pace and everything, like between Fletch and Jodan Baker, and then between Fletch and his ex-wife's lawyer. That's really where Ritchie makes it work.
Yeah.
The creeping around the real estate office and creeping around the woman's abandoned home stuff is, you know, serviceable, but not memorable.
Yeah, I mean, the abandoned home one in Utah. The whole Utah trip, I'd totally forgotten about it. Even though the second scene is memorable, when he meets Tim Matheson's parents, only because there's such a disconnect. And a more serious movie would have played with how that worked out, like that there was a disconnect between how Tim Matheson was playing his character and how this character was revealed to be. But I mean, it's a complaint, but I guess it doesn't really matter in the case of Fletch, because that's not what they're going for. They're going for it's hard to say they're just going for a good time, but I mean, they are. They're just very proud of what they're doing.
They're going for a comedy that's also a mystery, and because it's a mystery, there are some stakes involved, hence a car chase, hence Harold Faltermeyer music.
Harold Faltermeyer.
Yeah. Music really does so much for a movie. It really gives a movie a character. I got to look up how many other movies he's done, because I swear he's really, really has not done that much in terms of music scores.
No, I don't think he has, but he has done a movie called Fletch Lives.
Yeah, let's... okay, real quick, before Fletch Lives. Meyer's Greatest Hits, Beverly Hills Cop, Fletch, Top Gun, The Running Man, Tango and Cash. Ew.
Ooh, we saw that for the podcast. Yay! Go back and listen to that. It was awful.
And then some other stuff that you haven't heard of, but I mean, he's only done 28 things, and that's including about half of those are like TV movies and stuff. So, not a lot, but always pretty memorable.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah. All right. Well, you know, Lives. First of all, it came out 4 years later, so it's not like Chevy Chase was like itching to do a sequel right away. I guess he was, you know, busy oversaturating the market with himself and other. But by the time Fletch Lives comes around, well, let's say you go to the movie theater and you see the poster for Fletch Lives, and the poster for Fletch Lives is a parody of the poster to Gone with the Wind. And you're just like, what? Like, oh, it's neat that they made a sequel to Fletch. I like Fletch, but...
But why does it look like this?
Is it a parody of Gone with the Wind? I don't understand. And then you buy your ticket and you go and you sit down and you know, as the Universal logo shows up, you start hearing Meyer music, and it's new Faltermeyer music, and it's got that mystery feeling to it. It's like and Fletch Lives comes up on the screen, and you're like, all right, we're in business here. And then the Chevy Chase narration starts, like with Fletch, and he's talking about how a Greek restaurant is involved in crime, and then you have some really bad dialogue of Greek gangsters talking about how they're going to launder their money through a seafood restaurant. And then you see that Fletch is in the other room listening in on this, and yeah, he's wearing another wacky disguise, only this time it's no more than a maid's dress. And then like 30 seconds later, some old Greek guy is like pinching his bottom.
Yeah, and at that point,
you know what you're in for. I mean, I've never seen a movie really, even like 10 years ago or something when I saw this for the first time, I just knew that it was this was not going to be good. I mean, makes you lose your faith in it really fast. Like at about the 1:30 mark.
Yeah.
When you see Chevy in that dress and that wig, because like how little respect for your intelligence does this movie have?
Well,
and that's before he goes to the South.
That's before he goes to the South, and then when he gets to the South, you've got Cleavon Little as a I mean, okay, we got to wait on that. So, yeah, I don't know if I said this in the pre-show or if we'd just been talking about it, but, you know, I remember seeing Fletch Lives, or maybe I even mentioned in the show, but I saw it. It was one of the first movies I saw by myself or with friends, but without my parents, like at the opening night show, and it sucked. It sucked when I was 10. I was 10 at the time. I hadn't even turned 11. And I knew it sucked. And maybe I've seen it again because I sort of remembered some of the mystery. And I can't believe I remember it from when I was 10. But going back and seeing it again, seeing this terrible late 80s movie. Like 89 is a really weird year because there were lots of sequels in 89 and lots of movies that became sequelized. I mean, 89, the summer had, what was it, Star Trek V, Ghostbusters 2, Lethal Weapon 2, Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. Then you had like Weekend at Bernie's, which they made a sequel to. So, I mean, it was just a very big year for franchise continuations and starters. And
yeah.
one of the things when you watch Fletch Lives is, especially when you watch it in close proximity to Fletch, Chevy Chase aged like shit in 4 years. He ate a lot of junk food, and he aged like shit. His hair's, like, going, and they're trying to hide it. His face is put on weight. You know, there's the, there's when you watch Paul Newman movies, there's a point around Slapshot when he transitions from looking like young Paul Newman to old Paul Newman. Like, you know, he ages, but he's from one point on, he looks the same way. This is a movie. Fletch Lives is a movie, and I don't remember Christmas Vacation being like this, which is weird, but maybe I wasn't watching Community the last time I saw that, but you watch Fletch Lives and you're like, that's the guy from, that's the fat jerk from Community, only younger. Whereas in Fletch, you're like, hey, what a Hollywood leading man. I bet he was in Foul Play. Yeah. And so, I mean, it's like, I've always known it sucked. And then, but watching it this time, I didn't realize so many people from the first movie, not the actors, because everybody who comes back from the first movie and this one is awful. I mean, the Libertini's terrible in this. I mean, some of it's the writing, but still, I mean, it's just, you know.
Yeah, they bring back Libertini. They bring back
the lawyer.
The ex-wife's lawyer. They even bring back the Underhills in a cameo in this bizarre Song of the South parody dream sequence. I don't know if you noticed, but the Underhills are dancing along with them.
And that,
which is so – it's so weird because of the returning supporting cast and – I mean, they didn't bring back Gina Davis, obviously. Because of the returning supporting cast and because they bothered to reconstruct the apartment set a little bit and because they got Harold Faltermeyer again, it kind of seems like they were serious about making a sequel for people who actually enjoyed the first movie. But then it's like, why did they choose to make up this plot, which wasn't even one of the original novels? I mean, there were like 12 novels that they could have chosen plots from, and they didn't want to use any of them. They came up with this cockamamie story about Fletch goes to the South. And it's really bad because, like, when that happens in the first 10 minutes or whatever, he quits his job as a reporter to go inherit this mansion in Louisiana. So right away, it's like, you know, you're taking the essence of the character and throwing it away. And there's no – and God, I don't even know how long it is until the move into the movie before you see him put on another disguise again. But I'm almost sure this script wasn't written as a Fletch sequel. They just kind of shoehorned that into it.
Well, okay. So,
and you have to wonder why, because they really had a lot of stories to choose from, all of which would have been better than this one.
And the other thing is that. I mean, obviously, I saw Fletch before you did, timeline-wise. But when I saw it, you know, everybody really liked Dana Wheeler Nicholson because she holds her own against Chevy Chase. Not in a different way than Goldie Hawn did in Foul Play and Seems Like Old Times, but she was a really good – she played off him really well. And she doesn't come back, which, you know, isn't unexpected, except they then turn Fletch into this, you know, women can't resist him, you know, and all this crap. And what's funny about that is that if the first Fletch was some sort of a likable Chevy Chase.
Oh, boy.
This one is the one where you're like, this is what Chevy Chase is really like. He's like, no, I need to sleep with another woman. I'm the movie star here.
The point of no return for Fletch's unlikability in this movie is at about the 20-minute mark, he's slept with this woman who's a lawyer and who is releasing his aunt's estate to him. he sleeps with her. Someone poisons her in the middle of the night. You got the Harold Faltermeyer music happening in the background. There's a mystery developing. Fletch wakes up the next morning next to a dead body and wisecracks about it. Like, he's totally nonplussed that the woman he slept with that night is dead next to him, and he just cracks wise, and it's a shitty wisecrack too. He's like, oh well, it wasn't that good. And you're just like, do I really have to? Is this our hero? Oh my god! He's certainly a dick in Fletch Part One, but he's not a monster.
Well, let's not forget that a couple minutes earlier is the scene where he's – so Cleavon Little plays the mansion's caretaker, and he plays it like a self-aware step and fetch it because it's Cleavon Little. You know, like, it's okay to laugh at this.
Yeah, because it's Blazing Saddles guy.
Right, yeah, it's fine. But, you know, in the context of the movie – there's one point where Fletch makes a crack about, like, what does he say?
He says to Cleavon Little, like, have you ever heard of the Emancipation Proclamation?
No, not that one. The one where, before he leaves, where he's like, I wish I could find it. But, I mean, he says something incredibly just, like, hurtful and just awful to the guy. And you're like, what the hell? Like, okay. And at that point, I'm like, wait a minute, I think Cleavon Little's really, you know, not dumb. And they later, like 30 minutes later, they say that, Fletch is catching on that he's not that dumb. But the problem is that you've got the character's name is Calculus Entropy. Like, who the hell wrote that?
Leon Capitano.
Right. I mean, like, so this guy thought that was good. Like, that's out of, what, that's out of Hitchhiker's Guide for the Galaxy, right? That doesn't belong in a Fletch movie. Leon Capitanos had a pretty okay career from 74 to, well, not 74,
still
but
Fletch.
76. Yeah, from 76 to Fletch 89. And, you know, what happened? Oh, Fletch Lives happened.
His career deserved to die.
Yeah, I mean, the guy's not dead. He's still alive. He has absolutely no credits whatsoever after 1989, after Fletch Lives. And you can see why. Like,
why would anyone want to, I mean, I guess, you know, I said that, like, I was shocked at how anti-LAPD Fletch 1 was. I'm shocked at how anti-South Fletch Lives is. I mean, I don't even remember it being, like, this much of a cartoon brutalization of the South where everyone is either a Klansman or a Nazi biker rapist or, you know, just a dumb step and fetch it, or a murderous, you know, cop. This is the most anti-South film since, I don't know, 2000 Maniacs or something.
Okay, so it came out in 89. I'm just trying to think, were there any... Okay, so Fletch Lives feels like Lorne Michaels produced it. He didn't. It had nothing to do with Saturday Night Live, but it feels like an awful Saturday Night Live movie. It feels like a spoof of Fletch done by Saturday Night Live in a lot of ways. And so a lot of it seems reactionary. Like, the Southern setting, I'm like, did something come out in 87 or 88 where the South got big? Steel Magnolias wasn't until 89. So, you know, why they would think that... Okay, and we haven't even talked about the fucking costumes.
Yeah, the
the
disguises, as I said, are even worse in this one. It's not so much, I mean, maybe it's not that they're worse, it's just that they linger on them for so much longer.
So, and for nonsense scenes.
And for no reason, yeah. It's like there's this scene that goes on forever where Arlie Emery plays a, you know, Jerry Falwell or type, and doing, you know, a TV show in a megachurch, And there's just this awful, unfunny scene that goes on forever where Fletch in disguise has to go on stage with him and pretend that he's a faith healer too. And it's just unbearable because at that point, Fletch in disguise has already like gotten whatever information he needed to sneak into the office to get.
I feel like the other one in this one is that they're like, oh, well, kids like Fletch, so they'll like this one, and we'll gear it toward the PG audience instead of if the Fletch audience had grown up, right? Like,
yeah, yeah.
And so what you have with the costumes is you have that they're outlandish and they're stupid and, you know, they're funny. They're supposed to be funny in that way. They're just supposed to be a gag joke.
The other thing that's terrible about them is that he affects really stupid voices, really stupid southern accents for each disguise that he goes into.
And somehow
the people who he has to fool with these disguises and voices are just even – well, they would have to be even dumber than the people he fools in Fletch One because, like, he goes into a biker bar and says that he's the – grandson of Harley Davidson, and they all believe it.
Yeah. I mean, not just that, but this one has Fletch in disguise, like, fooling people who've already met him.
Right.
And it's not, like, a good disguise. Like, in the first one, when he's doing the roller skating Hindu guy or whatever he's supposed to be, it works. Like, it's a really good disguise. You can tell they had a real makeup artist work on him. And it'd be impossible for Fletch himself to get a disguise that good. Like, that's the willful suspension of disbelief right there. But in this one, he's, like, got his hair slicked back and he's talking to somebody. The cop. That was the first time I noticed it. He does the dumb repairman, the mechanic from the first one. He does him the same character for the cop. And it's like, well, his face is exactly the same. So what if he's got in those 49-cent novelty teeth?
Yeah, and when he's doing when he's pretending to be a faith healer to fool Arlie Emery met him like 20 minutes earlier out of disguise, and
yeah,
it's just like, and they're not just like passing through either. I mean, they are like 2 feet away from each other both times, so
it's a really bad script.
And let's just talk about the plot for a second. I mean, okay, so he inherits a mansion in Louisiana. He immediately quits the job because, you know, you don't want a Fletch sequel where Fletch is a reporter again. He goes down there and he finds out that it's a dump, and then someone, you know, kills the lawyer. Someone's trying to frame him. Someone wants that land. We think it's probably Arlie Emery, but then it's not. It's actually another guy. That's the plot. It's not exactly full of twists and turns, you know?
No, and it's one of those sequels where you are shocked to see it's the same people who worked on it because they clearly don't know what made their first venture work.
I guess not. That's the only explanation.
My question is, so this one runs 94 minutes. The first one ran 98 minutes, and I'm just approximating. But so this one has no secondary case. It's just
right.
That. And so you're like, well, how do they fill the rest of the runtime? Because the girl in this one's in it even less than Dana Wheeler Nicholson was in the first one. She's just, their scenes are just really memorable because they're so good. What did they do? They drug the freaking thing out unbearably. Like the Harley Davidson scene, it goes on twice as long as it needed to, and there's a chase scene, and it's an incomprehensible nighttime chase scene where you find out that Fletch rides a motorcycle better than Steve McQueen. I mean, it's just, it's idiotic.
Right, right. Yeah, the whole Southern thing, I mean, like, who wanted to see Fletch go to the South? Like, why was that... Why take him out of Los Angeles? They've got this – was it just cheaper to – was there some huge tax incentive?
I'm wondering if there was a huge tax incentive because it's filmed in
to shoot it on. They make a big deal in the credits about how it was shot on location in Louisiana. And it's like, did the people of Louisiana see this movie? It's like they shot on location so that they could just brutally mock the entire region of the country, the entire state. It's like, man, it'd be like if a film were shot in Michigan now with all of its tax incentives, and the whole film was about like the Michigan militia plotting to assassinate Obama or something.
Oh.
It's that non-complimentary to the South, let's say.
Loose women there, though. Every woman in the movie is very loose.
Oh, yeah. All right, I'll give Fletch Lips credit for one thing. It does finally get Chevy Chase, Randall Tex Cobb, Hal Holbrook, and Arlie Emery into a scene together. And no other movie can say that.
Wait, which scene?
Oh, just at the end when, you know, Hal Holbrook shoots at Fletch.
Tex Cobb's already gone.
Oh. Well, anyways.
It's not as cool as you thought it could be. And that's like the thing is there is some good – you do have goodwill toward it at times. I mean, Emery's good in this. Like, he probably gives the best performance. He's good as the preacher. Because he's not guilty, and so, like, he's just an asshole. Like, he's just, like, this he's a sincere asshole who thinks, like...
You fall evangelical.
Yeah, which makes him funnier. And then Hal Holbrook, you feel bad for, because you're like, God, Hal Holbrook, you've been playing bad guys for, like, 17 years now, and now you got one that, like, the whole point of your character is you're a bad Southern guy with a mama fixation. But Randall Tex Cobb, he should be a lot funnier because his first scene, he's like half in drag.
He's going to rape Chevy Chase, which is already hilarious.
And they never bring that back. When he comes back to the movie, the whole transvestite thing's gone, and it makes you go, is there like a 2.5 hour version of Fletch Lives that's just awful? Where like Chevy Chase, that explains, you know, where Cleavon Little goes for the second half, that explains.
Yeah. You know what's kind of uncomfortable is that, like, even though Fletch quits his job in the first reel, they bring back Richard Libertini again. Like, he calls up Richard Libertini and he's like, hey, Frank, I need you to look into something for me. And instead of him saying, no, you quit, fuck you, he actually...
Oh, does it.
He does some research for him.
And then he has, like, a sidekick. Remember in those scenes, he always has somebody in the room with him? Mm-hmm. And it's like, I just got to do this for Fletch. And it's just like, this is fucking idiotic. Like, it's the worst sort of sequel pandering where they're like, well, if we bring back somebody from the first movie, it'll be fine.
Right.
You're shocked that they didn't walk past like a picture of Gina Davis on a magazine or something. It's like that.
In memoriam. It's too bad Larry died, you know? Boy, who would have thought? I think Fletch Lives is kind of memorable in movie history because I don't think a potential franchise was ever killed so decisively by its first sequel, you know? Blair Witch, yeah. Right? Book of Shadows. Horror movie franchises have survived worse. I mean, Freddy's Revenge didn't stop them from making a whole bunch of other Nightmare on Elm Street movies. With comedies, it's different. And I remember reading some quote, somebody involved in the first Fletch, like maybe it was Andrew Bregman who wrote the script, or maybe it was Michael Ritchie. I don't think it was, though, because, you know, Michael Ritchie had to answer for Fletch Lives, too. But they were saying, like, you know, if Fletch Lives hadn't sucked so bad, there could have been, like, a dozen of them because it's such an easy franchise. It's just put Chevy Chase in a variety of goofy disguises and have him solve a different mystery. And there's already a whole series of mystery novels with the plots already, you know, written for this. And it could have been like the words that the guy used was that it could have been the 80s equivalent of the Pink Panther series. And you can totally see that. Like I said, you know, in the when you first see Fletch step into the newsroom in Fletch Part 1, it feels like, yeah, there should be a whole bunch of movies where he goes out and has adventures and then comes back to the newspaper room to write the story and haggle with his boss about his expense account. But Fletch Lives just throws out the baby with the bathwater and for no good reason at all.
Yeah.
So they tried to Kevin Smith, as I mentioned, yeah. You know, I found out that he was going to make a sequel or a relaunch or something with Jason Lee, and that got me interested in the original movie. That never happened, obviously. And it seems like they keep trying to this day, they're trying to relaunch Fletch as a franchise, but it's just not coming together. And I think like the first few attempts were sort of foiled by Chevy Chase himself, because Chevy Chase was like, well, I'm not too old to play Fletch again. And then Kevin Smith was like, what if we had you, you know, flashing back to your first case? And then Jason Lee is young you. And he's like, nah, I don't like that. And then, I don't know, it was going to be with Ben Affleck, and then Gigli came out, and then it was going to be with Zach Braff from Scrubs, and then that didn't happen. And then apparently the last time they tried to do it, it was with Joshua Jackson as Fletch and Steve Pink directing. And I don't know, maybe that's how it'll happen now. I mean, they'll get around to it eventually because everything is remakes these days, but it really seems like a no-brainer kind of franchise to try to launch. And maybe, I don't know, maybe that's why they're trying to take care with it. But at the same time, it's not like Batman, you know? I mean, don't overthink it, guys. And if you do, don't do it the way that Chris Nolan did.
Wait. Fletch with Christian Bale is a tortured Fletch.
I see it.
He hates having to put on those costumes. He hates it.
Right. And there's lots of inner expository dialogue about how, you know, he puts on disguises because ordinary people wear disguises every day, and Fletch knows that, and he's, you know, he is his mask.
Hold on, Michael Caine can be Libertini.
Right. Maggie Gyllenhaal, Harry.
Marion Cotillard or whatever her name is can be in it. Yeah, I mean, you can. Well, I think the problem they're going to run into if they ever do get around to it is that the genre is gone. The investigative reporter genre, Fletch came out in 85. Mean Season was, I think, 84 or 86. It might have been 85, too. That's the one with Kurt Russell as an investigative reporter who gets involved with a serial killer. The genre's pretty much gone. I think the last serious one was The Insider. And that's been 13 years. No, there have been some more, but I never saw the one with Anakin Skywalker, Broken Glass. But that was a corruption one.
Glass, that's a good movie.
Yeah, that's what I heard. But yeah, I mean, it's like you'd almost have to do it as a period piece where then you'd fall into the Starsky and Hutch / Anchorman trappings.
Maybe that's why they want Steve Pink to do it. Maybe he is going to make it a period 80s movie. That sort of is the only way to do it now, though. Yeah, you're absolutely right about investigative journalism having gone the way of the dinosaur.
I mean, can you imagine how bad it'd be? It's like, he's a blogger. He's got his laptop with him.
He's going to be Twittering. Going to
no,
find
oh,
out.
Even better.
Fletch, oh, hatch. That's going to be the relaunch title. It'll be Fletch, and it'll have the number pound next to it.
He could tweet pictures of his disguises when he gets done and be like, LOL, I fooled those people at and what's it called? And then, you know, he'll be walking to his car and they'll come out and they'll kill him and that'll be the end of it. And that now sounds like an Andy Samberg SNL skit.
Yeah. Andy Samberg. Andy Samberg is another potential Fletch. That's fun. That's the funny thing. Like, if you're thinking about, like, oh, if they made a new Fletch movie, who would it be? It could be anybody.
It's not hard, you know? Like,
that's about the character of a wisecracking reporter. Like just get wildly competent comic actor, and that's all you need. And preferably someone who could actually pretend to be different people. Variety of disguises, hence the Peter Sellers comparison to Fletch.
Yeah,
but Fletch lives it so bad it makes you angry while you're watching it, and you feel like time is slowing to a crawl, and you just loathe Chevy Chase by the end of it.
Well, you loathe everyone, because that's the thing about watching them. I don't know. How far apart you watch them, but I watched them apart 3 days. And so you're like, what happened to Michael Ritchie in 4 years? Did he like lose depth perception? Did he all of a sudden go, you know, we don't really need to try that any other way. Just boring shots. Every shot in Fletch Lives is either bad or boring. There's like this weird panning shot when they show the, when they show the mansion, we didn't even get to this, but the mansion that he inherits is a shithole. That's the joke. They ripped off the money pit for a Fletch sequel. But there's this panning shot where, you know, he looks up and he sees one corner of it and pans quickly, very quickly, to the right. And you see the rest of the crappy Southern plantation home. And I'm just like, what is this, a sitcom? Like...
That reminds me, there's actually a completely incompetent editing mistake when he's talking to the lawyer in the mansion, and it cuts to her for like half a second, and then it cuts back to him. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
It's really weirdly disorienting. Like, even in the worst movies, you never see those kind of editing mistakes, but it's just like this half a second reaction shot that is not a reaction shot to anything. It's just a totally pointless half-second cut to the other actor, like, while Chevy Chase is still talking, I think.
Is that the one where they're trying to imply that they, like, walked 15 feet? Or is that a different one in that same scene? Because when they get out of the car, they, like, jump through space. And, I mean, hey, it's my conspiracy. There's really a 2.5-hour version of Fletch Lives out there that's just, you know... They modeled it after Gone with the Wind or something, you know, just something. If they'd done that, if they'd gone the other route and just been really taken with the whole idea of doing like a Fletch Southern sequel, and you know, it's like that whole thing, how Girl Interrupted's really Wizard of Oz or some shit like that. But yeah, Fletch Lives was really Gone with the Wind. Well, let's not forget why the hell is it called Fletch Lives?
Because somebody thought that was funny.
Okay, but who? I mean, it's like, who thought this was good? And there's some, I think on the IMDb trivia page for Fletch Lives, they're like, even though there were 12 sequels to Fletch, the Universal Studios decided to do a, you know, original sequel to it as opposed to adapting. It's like, who made this terrible decision?
I know we've said this about quite a few movies, but the story of the making of this movie would be such a better movie than the movie.
Well, because you know a lot of it is, they're like, Chevy, do you want to do Fletch? He's like, no. My cameo in The Couch Trip is going to bring in some really great roles for me. And then that failed. No. Caddyshack 2 is going to be a big hit. I don't need to do Fletch 2. And it's just like, you know that his ego must have demolished any hope for this one. Because, I mean, without Andrew Bergman back, and we didn't talk about the script very much, But I mean, the script for the first Fletch is it's really tight, and you know, it manages everything really well in the dialogue. The exposition never feels forced. I mean, it's a good script from Bergman, who, you know, I generally kind of like as a comedy movie writer. But the second one, this Leon whatever guy, he just sucks.
Yeah. You ever seen Moon Over Parador or Down and Out in Beverly Hills?
Down and Out in Beverly Hills I probably saw when I was a teenager, and I don't remember it being any good. Moon Over Parador, I think, was on, like, HBO a lot, and so I saw bits and pieces of it. They at least have Richard Dreyfuss. He usually can survive a shitty script. I mean, Chevy Chase can barely survive a good script, for God's sake. Like,
yeah.
You know, he needs a lot of help. So I was actually curious to see Moon Over Parador within the last few months. I'm like, oh yeah, Moon Over Parador. That was like one of Richard Dreyfuss's last like big solo gigs, you know, like as a comedy actor. But now I'm like, oh, it's Leon Casaputo. It's like, I don't want to fucking sit through that. Come on.
Exactly. Yeah. And Leah, and, you know, presumably Leon Casaputos or whatever is the reason that the movie opens at a Greek restaurant. You've got these Greek gangsters saying, we're Greeks. We're clumsy. We dance. We break dishes. You know, right off that mob money as breakage in the restaurant business.
Hold on, I forgot. Richard Belzer, who's one of the Greeks, he actually looks directly at the camera for like, you know, 2 seconds. And he's like watching the camera move, just right at it. They didn't cut it. They didn't reshoot it. I was watching it. Yeah, I disagree. It wasn't a minute 30 in that I knew this was going to be shit. I'm like, why is that guy looking at the camera? What the hell's going on?
Thank you for pointing out where Richard Belzer was in this movie. I noticed his name in the credits, and then I was like, where the hell was he? But I didn't feel obligated to try to find him. So thank you for pointing out where he was.
Yes.
The spot Richard Belzer game.
Is there anything
I don't know,
else
maybe...
we can...
Do you think maybe Michael Ritchie and Chevy Chase were like contractually obligated to do at least one Fletch sequel?
I mean, it's possible. The producers are the same, too. And this was sort of their last throw at Universal. They were out of there 2 years later because they did Soap Dish at Paramount. I don't know, but we...
It's either that they just really literally had no idea what made the first movie work.
I said this.
And when they...
I commented on this in the pre-show, and I said I'd get back to it, is that Fletch actually... signaled the sort of end of Michael Ritchie's career as a thoughtful director.
After this, you've got Cops and Robertsons, don't you?
Well, no. After Fletch, you have Wildcats, which I've never heard anything good about. I've always wanted to see it because it's the first Woody Harrelson and Wesley Snipes movie, you know, when they were a thing. They're not really a thing anymore, but they were a thing for a while.
You also got The Golden Child.
The Golden Child, that, you know, the famous Eddie Murphy bomb, The Couch Trip, which, you know, bombed. And then you have Fletch Lives, which sucks. And then you have Digstown, which is really good. I just watched it, you know, probably a couple of years ago, and it is good. And then you just have shit. In the theater, you know, Cops and Robertsons, we watched that for a podcast episode. So that's actually the second mention. We have that and we have Tango and Cash. And then, you know, I heard really good things about that Positively True Adventures of the Alleged Texas Cheerleading Murdering Mom. The Scout I never saw. That's the one with Albert Brooks and Brendan Fraser. I try to avoid the Brendan Fraser ones. The Fantastics was... adaptation of a musical or a play or something, and it's like this really tragic story that it's under 90 minutes and Michael Ritchie's original version was, I don't know, you know, let's see if they say much longer. Oh, there you go. The trivia is that it was filmed in 95, shelved for 5 years. Francis Ford Coppola chopped it up and to get it released. Yeah. So, I mean, the guy, before that, the guy made Downhill Racer. You know, Downhill Racer's awesome. The Smile's awesome. I don't remember Survivors, but... Yeah, so I mean, it's like Fletch somehow got him into the whole, like, I'm going to do jobs for the comedy guys, you know, Dan Aykroyd and that, the Saturday Night Live alumni club. And
Fletch doesn't, you know, exactly forewarn disaster because it's a good movie.
Exactly.
All,
that's what's weird.
Yeah,
about
that was definitely
it,
some kind of turning point for him. Oh, well.
Yeah. So.
I think we've done our time.
Yeah.
And, you know, if Kevin Smith ever gets around to making Fletch 1, that's W-O-N, but it's also O-N-E because it's a prequel story and thus perfect for a reboot, we'll see what happens. Although at this point I'd be really surprised if it was still Kevin Smith doing it. In fact, it's definitely not going to be him. But look for Fletch the Reboot in theaters sometime, probably in the next 5 years.
And
a more hard-edged, down-to-earth Fletch, you know. None of those goofy disguises.
Unless Robert Downey Jr. does it, in which case, oh, God, that he would. That's perfect. Robert Downey Jr., John Favreau, it'd be great. Anyway, next episode, we've got something a little different.
Yep, we've got The Little Shop of Horrors. Not the 80s musical, even though that was just re-released on Blu-ray with the original ending restored, and that's awesome, and, you know, we'll definitely mention that. But no, we're going to go back to the Roger Corman original because it's a really unique movie, a really unique black comedy from its time and very, you know, irreverent. And then we're going to talk about a really obscure British soft porn kind of ripoff called Please Don't Eat My Mother from 1972. And the original was made in 1960. So this is pretty late to be cashing in on the popularity of it. But Little Shop of Horrors and Please Don't Eat My Mother. So look forward to that next month. And for an Alan Smithy podcast, this has been Matt.
And this has been Andrew.
And thanks for listening. Just charge it to the Underhills.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of the Best of an Alan Smithy Podcast. This is Sarah Chapman. Good evening.